We just had Dina Bell LaRoche on the podcast. Dina is a partner at Sport Law. She is the founder of Grief Unleashed. And after her sister Tracy died 20 years ago, Dina started exploring death and bereavement and the study of thanatology. And we have a really interesting conversation about those subjects, as well as how she intertwines it into sport now. We speak about, her being a media attaché and a press chief at five Olympic Games. And she could really never have expected how much she'd be studying grief, what it means to other people, and how she now coaches other people and does speaking as well as facilitation on this topic. Glad you're here. Thanks for listening in. Hey, I'm Jordan Harding. I grew up watching my dad put on that suit and tie every morning and go out to successfully climb the corporate ladder. I thought I wanted to be him, but I was wrong. I needed to be me. To do that, I had conversations with incredible people to learn how they figured out this whole thing called life. I learned how they overcome adversity and pick themselves up when they've been knocked down. Now, I'm sharing those discussions with you so you can apply those same learnings to your life. Welcome to It's Not a Straight Line. Today on the podcast, I have Dina Bell LaRoche. She's the founder of Grief Unleashed, which is helping others reimagine a new relationship with loss. You're a partner at Sport Law, an integral master coach specializing in complex change initiatives, grief and loss support, crisis and trauma management, and leadership coaching. You've been a media attaché or press chief in five Olympic Games, and you have a deep understanding of what it takes to perform at the highest level. You're a published author. I understand you're a parent of three. Dina, it's great to have you. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Jordan.
So Dina, we were just having a great conversation about grief, and we want to get into the topic of Grief Unleashed, but I'm interested, how did you carve out a career in sport very early on?
So my passion for sport, I'll take you back to when I was eight and I was sitting in my living room watching Nadia Comaneci perform miracles on the bar. And I turned to my mom and said, "Mom, I'm going to the Olympics someday." And she didn't have the heart to say, "No, you're not, not in gymnastics anyway." So, sport has been a part of my life since forever. And I was not the best athlete. In fact, in grade school, I was always the last one, chosen for Murder Ball. What a great name, eh? Murder Ball.
Like, great name.
Can we maybe reimagine that? It wasn't easy in the early days, but I remember coming home and I'd won a silver medal in a long distance run. And the kids who used to kind of poke fun of me at me were then chanting my name. And that, a switch went off and I went, "Oh, I can be someone through sport." And so, my experience in sport in high school, did everything and I just loved sport. So when I became a journalism student in university, my honors research paper at the end was all on Ben Johnson and anti-doping and what happened to Canada, right? Because it was all in and around the Dubin inquiry. So it's not surprising then that after journalism school, I wanted to make a career in sport. And, I turned to my mom after I got named to the Canadian Olympic team and said, "Mom, I'm going to the Olympics." And she said, "Of course you are." So my passion for sport runs deep, and it's never been about the outcome. It's always been about the experience of watching people actualize, self-actualize, and forge such deep, profound relationships with their teammates, and to be supported by a coach who sees something in you, right? Who really sees beyond the 13, 14-year-old, Bambi on ice kid that I was, and saw potential and then invested in that potential until I could see that potential. That's why I love sport. So a career in sport just became a manifestation. And with a journalism degree, I knew right away I didn't want to be on this side of the mic. I wanted to be influencing the narrative about sport. So quickly went in and started working in communications, and then, you know, started working with the Canadian Center for Ethics in Sport, helped to shape a new narrative of healthy human sport called True Sport. This is taking you back like almost 25 years. And still we grapple in sport with this division between healthy human sport, which is our tagline at Sport Law, and winning. And this is just a false construct because both are mutually reinforcing, not mutually exclusive. But we still have room to grow in that space. So yeah, that's a little bit about my love affair with sport.
And you're still working in sport to this day, and you even combine your grief coaching into your work at Sport Law. Is that correct?
Yeah, I have to say, like, I'll take you back, you know, a moment in 2001, as you know, my younger sister Tracy died. And that was a before and after. In fact, I just published a song called Before and After. And that moment when someone you love dies, you know, I've talked to hundreds of people who are bereaved. There's always a before and after, or a series of befores and after. And so in 2005, 4 years after Tracy died, I just couldn't do it anymore. I was a mom of three young children, and I just couldn't stay inside the sport ecosystem that was hyper-competitive, hyper-masculine in its energy, so focused on outcome and divisive. And that was back in 2005. And I'm enthusiastic, right? Hopeful, optimistic. That is at my core. I was losing my joy. So I felt I had to choose between being a parent, a present parent and spouse, or a career person. And I don't do well with divisions like that. So I took a step back and reimagined my career and opened up a little communications company. And then my company, I was lonely, Jordan. I'm a people person. So I needed other people. And I crossed paths with my now business partner and dear friend, Steve, and Rachel Corbett and Hillary Finley, like these amazing people who founded Sport Law, Hillary and Rachel did, and just felt like I'd found my tribe. So I joined their threesome. We became a foursome. And now we have 17 or 18. It's hard to keep track of people that work alongside Steve and I at Sport Law, and do really beautiful work on behalf of the, you know, thousands of clients that we've been serving since 1992.
Dina, with Sport Law, there must be a legal component of it, but I imagine, where do you focus on with Sport Law?
Yeah. So for the longest time, we were Sport Law and Strategy Group, and our audience, our clients always just called us Dina and Steve from Sport Law, because they forgot about the other side. And I had to dig deep to get to a place where we could just call ourselves Sport Law. But here's what I appreciate, right? I have a minor in law. Mm-hmm. Without the legal framework that underpins any one thing, we're kind of lost. So there's something beautiful about honoring legalities, right? The foundation where I can then build a home, you know, an organization that's going to strive to do what we ought to do, right? Our ethical, our moral imperative. And that's the land that I play in. So Steve, you know, there's a portion of our shop that's more like focused on the legal, the policy, the governance, the risk. And then there's, the emerging part of the business that's been since I joined 15 years ago, that's really focused on the people, right? The leadership, the decision-making, like how do we know we've made a really great decision? The leadership design around who are we when we're leading? That's what, you know, what I focus on.
And so you mentioned, Dina, the loss of your sister. And, you know, I think it goes back 20 years. You mentioned a before and after. Can we just dance in that for a little bit and speak? You know, you also mentioned right after that, your career, you saw shifting. You didn't want to be in that same kind of competitive sport world anymore. Just take us back to kind of that time and how you were trying to navigate.
Yeah. Well, I feel it in my bones. Anytime I go back, and I think that's actually one teaching for your listeners, is we will experience grief for the rest of our lives. it isn't a linear, you know, if I do this and this and this, it'll be over. Because then that means that the attachment I had to my person will be over. Right? Grief is this natural experience that's involuntary. I really want to underscore that. We can't control grief. It is an experience that needs to be metabolized. And it gets triggered, it gets experienced when we suffer through a loss, which is a severed attachment, kind of like imagine a bone breaking. Our natural experience would be, ouch. And it's going to take a moment before the bones refuse, right? But you need to give it time and space to become healthy and whole again. But there's always going to be that crack where the loss occurred. And so for me, you know, when Tracy died from cancer on February 17th, 2001, my baby was 16 months old and hers was 13. In that moment, you go back to what you know. And I knew how to perform. I knew how to be stoic and strong and brave, in air quotes, not realizing that this experience that I was going through and the suppression of my grief would come back 7 years later and say, you need to be in this experience. You can't keep shoving it down and only opening it up when you run, which is when I really let the steam off, was when my body was in motion. Our emotions need motion, right? Mm-hmm. And the suppression, I want to give you an analogy, Jordan. Imagine a beach ball and holding it, trying to hold it underwater. We've all done that as kids, right?
Yes.
And the effort it takes to keep that beach ball down, suppressed underwater, anybody who struggles with mental health will understand what that's like. We need expression, not suppression. But in a society that rewards stoicism, right? And put it behind you and focus on what's next. And let's not talk about the stuff that scares us. That death denying, grief phobic culture that is invisible to us. And I would say that capitalism at its worst reinforces how we want to tame grief, how we want to manage our way through this. The grief is like childbirth, right? Watching someone die is like watching someone being born. It is an awe-inspiring experience where you are fully human in a way that is really hard to describe. And you become humble, a humble servant of life. If you say yes to the invitation, which took me, you know, 7 years, because I was in such pain and busy having two other children and breastfeeding and figuring out life. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love how you're mentioning stoicism and bravery, these things that we're all told so many times, right? And you're right, with mental health, I know if you continue to suppress it, you know, it just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. When did you start to want to study kind of grief and death? I think the study is called Thanatology. What happened at that end of the 7 years where you're like, okay, the way I've been approaching this is no longer serving me?
Yeah, great question. So after 7 years, I started thinking, I want to do something different, right? So I was just starting to connect with the Center for Sport and Law that has now become Sport Law. And I was immersed in risk management land, where I was courting sport organizations to help them become really good risk managers. It was a big project that I'd helped to design alongside the Canadian Center for Ethics and Sport. But the theory, the rationale, the motivation to do this was not to become exemplar risk managers, but to adopt a philosophy of being called management by values. And so in management literature, you know, I stumbled alongside, and it's very central to my roots around being hopeful, right? Like really early on in my career in sport, I believed in sport and wanted to frame what sport could do through true sport, right? These seven principles that describe sportopia, if you will. And so that same kind of energy was alive in me. Like, why can't this philosophy of an ethic around what's good and right and true? Why is it so hard? Well, it's so hard because our system wasn't designed to achieve that. Our system is privileged and inequitable and focused on the 1% when it really should be designed, reversed engineered. So I would say, you know, this deep desire for me to understand this management ethos around values and orientation around what matters most was so alive in me. So I went back like anybody does and did a master's because I wanted, you know, to really understand this. Remember, I'm a journalist student, right? Like
yes.
I was very curious. So in my master's thesis, I uncovered this whole way of being that really cemented my deep, deep need to live a life in alignment with my values. And my three values are courage, compassion, and community. Courage, compassion, community, just like allow that to sit between us, because when you have language to describe your core values, all the other decisions become so much easier. And at the turn after my master's, I just went, I need to keep going. So they wanted me to do a PhD. And I said, no, I don't want to teach this stuff. I want to be, I want to live, I want to lead in this stuff. And then became an integral master coach. And that's when my undoing really began, right? So I started exploring the caves. I looked at my mom's journals from the moment Tracy was diagnosed with cancer to the day that I said, Mom, I want to go back and do a research project on all of your journal entries. And that was my great undoing. And it was the hardest experience going back and witnessing my mom's pain at the death of her daughter, my sister. And through reliving that, I was starting to acknowledge my own grief, because what I acknowledged and discovered is my grief was secondary to everyone else. My parents, my brother-in-law, my nephew, like I was putting my grief in a hierarchy, and it's called disenfranchised grief, right? A lot of siblings feel like no matter the age, you want to protect your parents because your parents are your stability. So as a child, you need to make sure your parents are okay, because that you know, imperative, that biological imperative says, if your parents are okay, then I'm more likely to be okay. So my undoing began really in earnest when I was back at school studying, you know, management by values. But then I was drawn to do this research on my lived experience and my mom's experience through grief for this qualitative project that had nothing to do with grief and everything to do with my own journey. That was the beginning, the epicenter, me understanding what was happening to me. And then through there, just finding opportunities to become more versed in thanatological study. And then in 2017, you know, started to do more courses, and then found King's College University and just took a deep dive. And so I'm still, like, I'm taking my ninth course this January in 2024, and it's on social justice, which is something that I'm becoming increasingly passionate about, right? Like, how do we, if we think grief is hard for the white, privileged, able-bodied, cisgendered person, can you imagine what it might be like for anybody who's different than the so-called norm, right?
Yeah, that's incredible work that you're doing. You mentioned before we hit record the idea of a soulful mermaid.
Yeah.
You know, can we speak about that?
Yeah.
How did that come about, and how does that relate?
Well, as an integral trained coach, right, we use metaphors to support our clients in their change journey. So usually clients come to us, you know, a lot of people go, what's the difference between a therapist and a coach? Because I've been told by athletes, because I do a lot of work with retired athletes, that an hour with me feels like 10 years of therapy.
Wow.
And I kind of just ask them, what is it about our conversation, our way of holding your experience that makes that true for you. And usually it comes back to, I understand the world of sport really, really well. So I can ask questions that maybe aren't as available to others. And then I can talk about grief in a non-pathologizing way. So I will go in and ask them about where are they feeling this pain in their body. And when I give them language to be able to describe grief, it is such a relief. So back to your question around, you know, why or how I came to the way of the soulful mermaid. Well, she's a newer expression of my journey right now. And maybe I'll share it this way. In the first decade of my grief experience, I was like broken, but I didn't know I was broken. And everything around me was like rewarding me for raising money for cancer and doing all this good work in Tracy's memory. So it was, there was a lot of stoicism around that, right? Can you feel it? Like the stoic mountain climber was my way of being. In the second decade, you know, from 20, basically 2011 to 2019, 2020, it was much more hopeful. And, but it was still externally checking because it was all about Tracy's hope and building schools in Nicaragua and school box. But there was an efforting around that, that I got tired of and less room for me. So now, you know, what I love about the mermaid is she's a bit mysterious and she needs to do the work on her behalf, right? There's a lot of folklore around her. And soulful, the soulful mermaid is much more interested now in my lived experience, in my grappling with who am I now if I'm not Tracy's bereaved sister, right? There was a bit of me hiding behind all of this like beautiful work that I'd put out into the world. And I'm so grateful that I did. This soulful mermaid now wants to spend more time excavating my caves, my needs on behalf of me. No efforting, no rewarding, no goals or objectives. It's just being in the experience. So metaphors can really help people reimagine a new way of being inside something that can feel really scary as well.
So how do you kind of apply something like the soulful mermaid or metaphors with your clients? And, you know, I'd love to know, with Grief Unleashed, like, how do you work with your clients around grief?
Well, I'll take you back to 2019. As I was immersing myself in the thanatological training and study, I had already been talking about grief and loss in the context of sport. Yes. And then I realized I needed to build a bridge to something else because this work around grief and loss felt like it was a calling, a purpose. And it was so much easier to be thinking about outside of sport, but I was doing a lot of work inside of sport too. And so building a bridge to Grief Unleashed and writing the book and putting that out there has been, you know, incredibly cathartic. And when, as an integral coach, when we're supporting our clients in their change, being able to give metaphors to their change initiative is freeing because you can see yourself in your experience. Well, tell me what your current way is. Like, how are you in this grappling, in this topic that you want to explore with me? How do you move? What is your thought process? What is good about this approach? And then what's limiting? So we create a metaphor to help you, my client, kind of see yourself outside of yourself, right? It's Robert Keegan's work around subject object. And when I can name it, I can tame it. Then we can talk about the longing. What are you longing to become? What is animating you? What is holding you back from achieving this vision of yourself or this objective or goal that you have? And so let's give some language and texture and color to that. And when we coach, we toggle between your current way, which feels familiar and comfortable, but you're outgrowing it, like that favorite pair of jeans that you had, right? And it served you, but it's no longer serving you. It's limiting you. And there's aspects of your current way that you want to take with you. And that's usually your values, right? The stuff that makes you, you. So we take that into, we transcend your current way, so to speak. And then we include the parts of you that still feel like you as you move into like another stage in your life. Is that helpful?
It is. It is. And do you want to give an example, or do you want to dance a bit in terms of like what you do with your clients? Did you want to try something?
I would love to do something live here. Yeah, with you.
Let's try it.
So well, let me ask you then, do you have a question? Like, what's popping for you that you'd like to explore in a maybe micro way right now?
Something I was thinking of is within sport, I imagine grief is beyond losing someone. It can be you leaving the sport you love. And then with me, a lot of times it's like, you called it earlier, anticipating grief, with thinking about people you might lose. You know, I always try to remind myself every day that life's so short, like, yeah. Right. And it's scary to think about. And then with grief, I always think back to my grandfather. I never met him. He passed away 15 days before I was born. And a lot of my father, as well as his two sisters, you know, I was born, and that created a lot of hope in their lives. And as the oldest niece or nephew, you know, I've quote unquote been special because I came along right after. And it's always interesting to think back when people say, oh, you're so much like your grandfather, and never meeting him.
Yeah. What was your grandfather's name?
Warren.
Warren.
My middle name, one of
your
my middle
middle
names.
Name. Oh, of course. Do you know that I named my third child Elisa Tracy LaRoche?
Wow.
So what's that like for you to have your grandfather's namesake?
It's special. It's you know, he did a lot of charitable work, and now I'm in that space as well. You know, it's special. It means a lot. It means a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And can you feel where that means a lot lives in your body?
Yeah. Yeah. In my heart, some of the jokes that I've heard he used to tell. I'm a shorter guy. He's a shorter guy. He used to always say on the golf course, it was great because he was the last to get water on his head when it rained.
Your grandpa Warren, I can just totally feel him through you, actually. Yeah. And so I think what we're teaching each other is we can miss people we never knew. Right? We can grieve in so many really subtle ways. The relationship I never had, the dream that was never fulfilled, right? The person I never knew, and yet I'm carrying his name. And both the honor and maybe a little bit of the heaviness around that as a new baby immersed in the pools of grief. And then all of this love and hope gets like contained in this tiny little child that was born, what, 19 days after?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can feel the, like, both the awe-inspiring moment of your birth and also the deep grief that might have been displaced a little bit because it's just so hard. And so we're going to focus on the joy, right? Which is also normal. These two things can go coexist, right? Jordan, Warren, right? But we don't do the sadness really well as a North American kind of culture where we've focused more on being stoic and brave, so-called, right? But the brave move is to be able to grieve a loss. And when we just sit with that for a moment, like, in what world does it make sense for us not to cry?
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And I'm a male that does that once in a while, and it has become open with speaking with my partner about that. And it was interesting as you were speaking with that, I was thinking about my grandmother, Warren's wife, who, you know, passed, and I was able to live with her for 3 months before I went off on a study exchange in my third year to France. And then, you know, I had to fly back 2 months later because she had passed. And I remember being at the funeral as the oldest of the cousins, just thinking I had to be brave because she was tough, and she was a strong person. And I felt like I needed to embody that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I didn't really focus on how I was feeling too.
Right. Yeah. And that's thank you for sharing that story. And so I think what we're teaching each other right now, because this is the work, right? It's teaching each other about this and pushing back against the invisible narrative often that keeps us stuck. So people grieve differently. And I would say there's more masculine ways of grieving, not necessarily male, but you know, you can go with this for a moment. Masculine ways of grieving that want to be more research focused, organized, let's do the funeral, let's focus externally. And I'm going to be okay in this, right? This way of like being with my grief. A more intuitive way of grieving, which is more feminine in its expression, is taking our internal turmoil and expressing that externally. So communing with others, wailing, right? Releasing the tears. And what I help people see is gender. So your biological gender can influence the way you grieve, but it isn't a determinant, right? It's not like because you're male, you're going to grieve this way, and because you're female, you're going to grieve this way. And then there's lots of different ways that we cope. You know, you have creative types, right? You've got the expressive types. You have the, as I said, the more like body types. I grieved when I was running and when I felt the need to clean out my closet and get some order in chaos. So when we become aware of our coping style, we can pause and disrupt that for a moment and say, hey, human, what's going on? Right? And we have healthy coping styles, and then we have less adaptive, maladaptive coping styles. And being curious about what's happening to us, because grief is not just an emotion, it's an embodied experience, right? It's a social, what we call biopsychosocial experience that can also have a spiritual dimension where our whole world changes, our assumptive world crumbles. Who am I now in the face of such loss? Which is what happened to me when my sister died. When my dad died last year, Jordan, it felt different. There was a bitter sweetness to it because he died from complications of dementia. And so towards the end, you know, he didn't speak my name. His body knew who I was, but not his, he couldn't verbally acknowledge that I was his daughter. And that too, you know, that ambiguous loss where someone is physically present, but psychologically absent, creates all kinds of pre-grieving that you shared with me earlier, like the anticipation that people I love are going to die. Yes, because that's what humans do. We're supposed to die. And the myth is that we're not supposed to die. What? So we put that loss in a box and we say, oh, that's for those people. We are those people. And until we live our life acknowledging that death is a part of life, it keeps us stuck. When we live our life understanding that there's a finiteness to it, and I see your beautiful smile right now, it's like joy becomes so much more available to us. And then we have the courageous capacity to live life on purpose and with purpose and say no to the things that no longer bring us joy. That's what happens when you do this kind of work. At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, and the intentionality there. And I did have a huge, huge smile as you were speaking about that. You know, what an incredible career and life you've had with the ups and downs and losing your sister, and you know, now being able to focus on this work. It's kind of, how do you balance the two with Grief Unleashed and Sport Law and a book? And I've heard you have Sportpedia, the podcast, or Sportopedia. It sounds like you really bring the grief work into the position at Sport Law. Like, how do you bring it all together now?
Yeah. Well, I'll take you back to that constellation we were talking about when we were warming up,
yes.
Having coffee together. I am a visionary. Like, we all have our superpowers, right? Is what you and I were talking about. And it's easy for me to close my eyes and imagine Sportopia. Like, if sport was at its best, what would it look like? Well, it would be fair and respectful, and people would give back, and it would be healthy, right? And people would feel included, right? And we would have fun. Like, these principles of true sport that I just shared so effortlessly, it's not difficult for me to be able to reimagine, to imagine a better way of being. And so I feel the same way about grief and loss. Like I can imagine a world where in schools, children are provided with the ABCs and 1, 2, 3s of grief and loss literacy, that the what to expect when you're expecting includes a chapter on how understanding attachment theory and why it's so important to be in tune with our children, right? Understanding and providing language to the bereaved, like just after the aftercare program, right? That we understand that grief isn't, there's no timeline to your grieving period. There is no mourning period, so to speak, despite the fact that in the DSM, it's now there as a prolonged grief disorder. So children after 6 months and adults after a year, if you're still presenting all of these symptoms, you might be, you know, you might have prolonged grief disorder. And so what I envision and what's so easy for me as a leadership coach is to be present to the human. And what I would offer in the, I'd say over, I've got 2,600 hours of coaching hours. That's a lot of hours, right? In every single conversation, there's usually a place where there's some, we can touch on sorrow or a sadness. And it's not all 10 out of 10. Like think of a dimmer switch, right? Some of the micro losses that we experience are still losses that we carry. And when we stack loss after loss after loss, it can create such hardship for us, unnecessary hardship. So in every conversation, I'm able to touch into this lens that I've kind of built for myself as a coach and ask, hey, you're something changed in your face. You know, you looks like maybe you're, there's a loss there. Do you want to talk about that? It's that easy for me.
And Dina, as we were warming up too, we were talking about kind of what you're up to now, what your passion or purpose is. And you mentioned something called Wind Phone.
Yeah, the Wind Phone. So I've partnered with the Ottawa Regional Cancer Foundation. I launched my book with them, and proceeds of my book right now are helping to go towards a project called the Wind Phone. And the Wind Phone comes from a Japanese gardener back in 2010 who created his cousin had died. It was really, really close to his cousin. So he found an old, you know, those British phone booths, those big red booths.
Yes.
Found one of those, put it in his garden, and then he took a phone like that wasn't connected to any earthly system, put it in this phone booth, and then he would go and visit the phone booth every day and have conversations with his cousin. A year later in 2011, a huge tsunami hit the coastal part of Japan, and it wiped out, like thousands of people died, washed out at sea. And so he found his phone booth that had blown away, and he went and he put it on a side of the coastal region, and people started to visit. And then word spread of this phone booth, this place where you could go and have conversations with your loved one. So around the world now, there's hundreds of Wind Phones. Huh. And some are just like an old phone on a tree. Some are more, you know, elaborate fixtures where people, the bereaved, can go and pick up a phone and have a conversation, dial that family phone number and have a conversation with their loved one. So in honor of my dad and my sister and all the bereaved people, this idea of bringing the first Wind Phone to Ottawa was kind of born in me. And I thought, well, I can use proceeds from my book and invite people to make a donation. So that's what I've done.
So if people want to make a donation to that, how do they do that? Do they purchase your book, which I encourage them to do, or can you donate directly to this
project?
Yeah,
you can do both. Yeah. So, you know, we've already got $450, I think, on there. So that tells you something. And the project, it's like next year, we're going to do this next year in collaboration with the Ottawa Regional Cancer Foundation. We have a project team. So we have a location. Now we just need some funds to like put up a structure and find a phone, like make a little phone booth. And yeah. So I'll send you the link. You can put that in.
Send me the link. I'll throw it in the show notes for sure. Dina, three quick questions. And if you have like one or two words or a phrase to close it out, what's one thing we should remind ourselves about loss as we head into holiday seasons, especially?
Make a plan. Like, really make a plan. If you're bereaved, make a plan, create your boundaries, communicate that with your loved one. And if someone says to you, "What's wrong? You look sad," you can say, "I'm a bereaved person. My person just died." Right? Give yourself language to be able to have clear boundaries for people who are, especially people who are early in their grief. This might be their first holiday season without their person. So, yeah.
What keeps you inspired on the topic of grief to keep going every day?
This, what you and I just experienced.
Love it.
One person at a time, honestly. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And what do you wish more people accepted about grieving?
Well, that they just acknowledge it's normal and healthy. And what a way to honor our loved one, right? Like, really? You know, the fact that I can still talk about Tracy, that I gifted her name to my third child, right? That I'm finding ways to honor her and incorporate her into my life 23 years after she died. Like, the literature gave me hope that what was happening to me was normal. And so I just wish people understood more about this so that they didn't feel abnormal in a normal experience called everybody's born, everybody lives, and everybody dies. And that to me is what it is to be human.
Yeah, I think that's important, like how to not feel abnormal through a normal human experience.
Exactly. Yeah.
Dina, thanks for being on the show. So great to speak with you.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
What did you take away from our chat today? I'd love to know. Let me know on Instagram at It's Not a Straight Line or connect with me on LinkedIn. If this episode was helpful, would you mind leaving me a review on whatever podcast app you use? I'd really appreciate it. You can always go back to previous episodes to hear more insightful conversations to help you build your own unique life. Thanks for listening to It's Not a Straight Line. Until next time.